some baby love helps to satisfy. It's my only job. Yeah, Edgar Allan, come on. Yo, check it. Yo, it's Tuesday morning, sunrise. The Streetwise LP been released, fully stocked today. Before you head out, you got a blast, righteous way to go. Just to get amped up for more flow now.
Hello, welcome to people say, second episode of East Coast Bias, the weekly sports podcast hosted by myself, Brennan Canny, and with my partner, Jason Mish. Today we'll be running down the NBA playoffs, Kobe Bryant, and debuting our underrated, overrated segment. Now, let's begin with the Utah Jazz and San Antonio Spurs, Game 5. Jason, what do you have?
Well, after watching last night, it was a very lopsided game, of course. The Spurs win by 20. And the first thing I noticed from the game was Deron Williams is healthy. He looked like he was hobbled.
Yes.
And I think he was a game-time decision for the game, but you know, you could definitely tell that he wasn't at 100%.
Definitely. His sprained right foot really came into play. He only scored 11 points to go along with 2 assists and only played 24 minutes.
And I think it was the same situation with Derek Fisher where, you know, he had a situation with his daughter. He wasn't at the game. He got there at halftime. So he really couldn't help the team either.
No.
But, you know, from the Spurs standpoint, it was a game they knew. You don't want to let the Jazz back into this series, so you take care of business on your home court, and I think that's what the Spurs did.
Yeah, they certainly did. I mean, San Antonio's largest lead during the game was 29 points. Utah shot only 38% from the floor, so the San Antonio defense was right there and kicking. Boozer had less than 10 points. I believe he had 9. This is his first game during these playoffs that he scored under 10 points. And the Spurs will have home court advantage regardless of who comes out of the Eastern Conference Finals because they had more regular season wins than the Cavs or the Pistons.
Yeah, and it was actually a funny game for the Jazz because normally in this playoffs it's been Williams and Boozer and that's it. They actually did get a balanced scoring from their bench and some of the other starters, but you know, you can't attribute that to the lack of playing time by the starters.
Sloan really, threw those guys in there. I mean, he knew that the Spurs were just on they're steamrolling them. There wasn't anything that Utah was going to be able to do to get back in this. So, you know, he just threw his guys out there to get them playoff experience, and the Jazz definitely are going to be right back here next year, barring any major injuries to Williams or Boozer. So this isn't going to be anything unexpected for the Jazz. They're going to be in the playoffs for a lot of years to come with Jerry Sloan still hopefully going to be their coach for many years to come, and Carlos Boozer and Deron Williams are going to be a fantastic duo. It's going to be a Malone Stockton 2.0. It's going to be a great thing to watch during the playoffs.
Looking forward for the Jazz, I think their only problem right now would be is at the 2 spot, the shooting guard. I think you can live with, as we made fun of Kirilenko in the last episode, but you know, he's a solid role player, and same with Okur after he did spend a lot of money for him. But I think replacing Fisher at the 2, and like you said, I think they'll be fine in the future with Williams and Boozer for sure.
Oh yeah, I definitely agree. Definitely think that they're going to be back there next year. Kirilenko, I mean, I thought he was going to turn out to be something huge. I really thought he was going to be a superstar in this league. And from his performance this year in the regular season and his horrible performance in the playoffs, I just see him, like you said, becoming a role player. And Okur, as good as he played this regular season, was terrible in the playoffs. And he really didn't do anything to help the Jazz. Basically, it was the Boozer and Williams show, and if those two guys didn't show up, and they didn't tonight, you can see what happens when neither of their superstars really get anything going.
From the Spurs side, you know, now they sit and wait to see who beats up on each other in the Eastern Conference Finals. And they were effective last night. Parker and Duncan, 14 for 27, combined for 42 points, and that's going to get the job done every time.
Definitely. And this is only the fourth time in the playoffs that Tim Duncan failed to achieve a double-double, which is incredible, considering I believe he's played 16 games. That means he's gone 12 of 16 with a double-double. I mean, the guy is...
He's been very impressive.
Yeah, I'm not going to call him underrated, because I think enough people are already saying that, but I mean, he's going to go down as one of the best, if not the best, power forward of all time, especially if he wins the NBA Finals, and I don't see anyone else taking the NBA Finals MVP away from Tim Duncan at this point.
It's definitely safe to assume that he would be the favorite for that award. They'd be the favorite for the winning it all. So obviously last night was Game 5 for the Spurs-Jazz. The Spurs wrapped it up. Tonight we have another important Game 5, Cavs-Pistons. Series moves back to Detroit. Brandon, what are some keys, you think, for the Cavs tonight if they want to win on the road?
Some keys for the Cavs tonight is that LeBron is going to have to have another Oscar Robertson-type performance. He's going to have to score points. He's going to have to dish out assists. He's going to have to rebound, and he's going to have to play some good defense. Drew Gooden is going to have to get involved like he was in Game 4. LeBron was really looking to him in the paint in Game 4, and Drew Gooden really stepped up and played very, very well. Daniel Gibson is going to have to continue playing well. Besides his 21 points, which is a career high for him, he played excellent defense on Billups and even was able to spot up and really help guard Tayshaun Prince, who's a huge matchup problem for most teams, and he did a very good job on him. And the Cavs, what they really need to do is play well in the third quarter. Cleveland is only averaging 14 points in the third quarter, while Detroit is averaging 22. LeBron, for the last two games, I believe, has been held to 1 point combined in Game 3 and Game 4.
And it's like 5 points for the series.
I believe so. It's something ridiculous where he's just not contributing at all. He's been great in the fourth quarter the last two games, in Game 3 and Game 4. He's been superb. But in Game 3, I don't know what happens. He shuts it down for whatever reason, or Detroit just ends up playing really good defense in the third quarter, but he gets nothing going. So what are the Detroit keys to beating the Cavs in Game 5 in Detroit?
First off, I like the Big O reference at the beginning there. That was very nice. But second off, of course it's going to be Chauncey Billups. And, you know, we've never seen Chauncey Billups play like this.
No.
And it's so uncharacteristic. Last game, he was 2 assists, 5 turnovers. He's going to have to step it up. Game 4... He had a costly foul on Gooden after missing. With about 50 seconds left, he took an ill-advised three. It was a bad decision. Made a quick foul on Gooden afterwards, kind of a dumb play on his part. He's going to have to step it up, get his teammates involved, control the tempo for the Pistons.
Yeah, I really...
Second off...
Go ahead, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Second off, I think Rashid's level-headedness maybe... Maybe not getting some technical fouls like he likes to do after he had another one last game.
Right.
But I think Rasheed Wallace is so important in the post. It gives him a good post presence, even with him and Tayshaun, who likes to bring it down on the blocks too. But, you know, Wallace is key, and he's going to continue to be if they want to be successful in this series. And something we saw late in the games that the Pistons have been doing is going to zone. To try to get two or three defenders on the same side of LeBron is at the end of games. I think they should instrument that more. It's been effective at times when they've done it, and it at least keeps four or five guys, at least the whole team, looking at LeBron.
Yeah, it's going to keep LeBron honest, but what killed them is that LeBron was then dishing it. Drew Gooden was taking some really nice cuts towards the middle of the lane, and LeBron was passing it to him, and he was getting some easy layups, couple dunks. So that the zone is working to keep LeBron somewhat contained, but if Drew Gooden gets open and he plays as well as he did last game, I don't know if the zone is really going to help out as much as Detroit thinks it's going to.
I'd like to give you some credit, because before Game 4, you said that Daniel Gibson would have to have a key game for the Cavs to win. That's and, right. Man, were you right on that?
Yeah.
21 points.
I wasn't expecting 21 points. From what I saw, he was playing some great defense, and that's really what I thought was going to change the game for them. if he played very good defense on Billups. I wasn't expecting him to score 21 points. But, hey, whatever the Cavs can do for second scores behind LeBron, I'm sure LeBron appreciates it.
The point about Gibson is, you know, a lot of the time it might be an unexpected player who's going to step up for him, much like Gooden did. You know, I don't think many people expected that kind of performance with Gooden.
No.
And he was knocking down, you know, the 17, 18-footers consistently last game, and the same with Gibson. So maybe it'll be a guy like Ilgauskas who played well in Game 3, maybe Pavlicek if Hughes is healthy, Farish out, you know, the list goes on.
Right.
So, but they're definitely going to need that.
What are you predicting for Game 5 in Detroit? Do you think Pistons or Cavs are going to pull this out? And who do you think is going to lead 3-2 going into Game 6?
To win in a place like Detroit is hard, and the only reason I would lean toward the Cavs early, about a week ago, I did predict Cavs in 7, so if you want to give me a little credit
for
that.
You did. I should give you a little bit of credit for that. You did.
But if you look at the series, winning Game 1 and open Daniel Marshall 3, you know, that could have went either way. Same thing with Game 2. And then games 3 and 4, basically the Cavs dominate down the stretch. So I will lean towards the Cavs, but it's going to be another exciting game. It's going to come down to the wire, for sure.
I'll have to agree with you. I think the Cavs are going to win as well. I believe LeBron is going to have a very good game. I think Gibson is not going to score 21 again, but he's going to prove to be a vital role for the Cavaliers. I think Gooden is going to play well again. As long as LeBron James is able to give him the ball and give him opportunities, and Gooden has to make good on those. Hopefully Iggy will get involved a little bit. He had 9-7, which is okay, but for how big he is, he should be dominating. He should be dominating Rasheed Wallace and Chris Webber. Chris Webber does not play defense anymore. His legs have given up on him, and Wallace does play very good defense, but he's undersized compared to Ilgauskas. But I believe that Cleveland will definitely pull this out. They'll lead 3-2, and I actually think the Cavs will win this in 6. But now that we're talking about basketball, let's get into Kobe Bryant. Apparently, he has demanded a trade from Los Angeles, but 3 hours later, he goes on the Dan Patrick Show and retracts his statement and says he would love to end his career as a Laker, which is a far cry from telling Stephen A. Smith on his radio show 3 hours previously, saying that he would rather play on Pluto than playing in L.A. in a Lakers uniform. What's your take on this, Jason?
You know, it's a weird situation. You explained it well, how he kind of backtracked or changed his mind later in the day. But I think from Kobe's standpoint, this is a ploy to let the Lakers give him what he wants. And I think one of the things he wants is obviously the talk of Jerry West as GM. And he needs better players around him. It's unrealistic to think that they could trade Kobe Bryant. It's just not possible. And I don't know what you think about that.
I was using the trade generator on ESPN. There are some things that you could do to make it work. But the chances of Kobe Bryant being traded and playing anywhere else, I just don't see that it's going to happen. It would be really interesting to see if he were to go to the East Coast, and the East Coast would have Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal and Dwayne Wade and LeBron James, so you can stop hearing all these people cry about how the Western Conference is so much better. It's just, I think if he were traded to an East Coast team, I think it would be fantastic for the NBA. And I think that David Stern is crossing his fingers saying, I really hope that he wants to get out of here. I really think that's the case, because I think if he were to go to a big market team like New York or Chicago, where they love basketball, it would be a great thing. But the chances of it happening, like you said, and I agreed, it just, the pieces won't be anywhere for him to be traded anywhere else. The pieces just won't be there.
You have to remember, he does have a no trade clause, so, you know, he could veto wherever he wanted to go, and that basically gives you the right to the team you want to go to.
And he can waive that, but the team that he would be traded to would have to absorb $13 million plus whatever his contract would be.
So, exactly, and That's why you don't think it's going to happen.
Right.
But
it's a big undertaking for anyone, even if you have cap room to undertake.
And I think the reason why he did this was he was so upset about the situation. You know, if you look at the last 3 years, they really haven't gotten better. No good young talent. Maybe Andrew Bynum, you can argue.
Maybe, but he's a high school kid.
So he's going to need time to mature.
Exactly.
A couple of the destinations they threw out there in today's USA Today was New York, like you said, to give the Knicks a star again.
Yeah.
Chicago, because of the young talent they have with Deng and Gordon and Heinrich. They also mentioned Philadelphia, which I think you and me can both agree that that would never happen for another reason.
I mean,
because of our hatred for Kobe Bryant.
Yeah, and the thing is that we wouldn't even hate Kobe as much as we would hate Billy King if he made this trade. And he may do it because he's that bad of a GM, and we'll get into that later when we do our underrated and overrated segment. And Kobe is not going to – is not going to go anywhere, although his frustration can be felt. Since the Lakers traded Shaq to Miami, the Lakers have only won 4 playoff games while Shaq has won a championship with the Heat. And another interesting dynamic about this whole story is the story about Jerry Buss, and that Kobe was not the person who said, hey, I want Shaq out of here. I want this to be the one-man Kobe show.
And that's kind of what ignited this whole story, I think. And that's what made these trade rumors palpable. You know, it was that how upset he was that the Lakers front office were placing the blame of trading Shaq on him.
Right. Right. And what I think what transpired was a Los Angeles Laker, a Los Angeles sports writer, he's a Laker insider, spoke to Lakers personnel, and the personnel told that reporter that Kobe was the reason, and Kobe said, "Nuh-uh, wasn't me." And Shaq even said that he believes Kobe 100% and 1,000%. So,
and coming from Shaq, you know, that's pretty good.
Yeah, and especially with what we thought was a very strained relationship between the two. And for him to say that he has no doubts that Kobe is telling the truth is a huge statement to Kobe Bryant and just how screwed up the Los Angeles Lakers are going to be for probably this upcoming season, because even if things get quote-unquote reconciled between Jerry Buss and Kobe Bryant, I don't think Kobe Bryant in the future will retire a Laker. I think if he goes into free agency or something, I really think he's going to consider going somewhere else.
Bottom line, Kobe's not going to get traded.
Bottom line, he
but
is not going
it
anywhere.
It definitely stirred the pot.
It definitely did, and it was a great story. Especially with the slow news week, with it just being the NBA playoffs and not a lot else happening. It was a huge deal, and it was a very interesting story.
Moving on now, we will do a weekly segment we like to call Overrated, Underrated. We're each going to pick 2 players, one that we feel is overrated and one that we feel is underrated, and we'll be taking both sides of that. If, Brendan, you would like to start it off?
I would love to. We touched on Barry Zito a little bit in our last episode. I believe that Barry Zito is the most overrated pitcher in baseball right now. His inflated contract, which is a 7-year contract, which he is paid over $126 million, that averages out to about $18 million a year. So he's getting paid $18 million a year to do this. Have a 4.22 ERA. He only has 8 more strikeouts than walks, which is 39 strikeouts and 31 walks. His 31 walks ranks 6th in the National League, and his 39 strikeouts ranks 41st in the National League. Since he has won his Cy Young in 2002, in that year he was 23-5 with a 2.75 ERA. He has a higher ERA than Carl Pavano, who hasn't even pitched since he's gone to the Yankees, has a lower strikeout rate than Mark Redman, and has a lousier WHIP than Odalis Perez. Now, does any of that justify him getting paid $18 million a year? It certainly does not. No, it does not. And he's only 5-5 with those Giants.
It's hard to say underrated for Barry Zito, but I'll do my best at defending okay. my boy. You know, I've talked about it earlier, how when you get something like a huge contract, you're the highest paid free agent, you know, in the market for last year. There's a lot of pressure that comes with that. And in Oakland, he had a supporting cast of Hudson and Mulder that kind of took the brunt of the pressure off him, so it was kind of balanced. And let's remember, he's only 29, so, you know, he's still young. And the reason why he got paid all this money is because of the 100 career wins. Like you said, 23-5, 275 in that Cy Young year of 2002. He has the best curveball in the game, and you can't deny that.
No, it's a gorgeous curveball. I'll give you that. Gorgeous
12-6. And arguably the best of the Mulder-Hudson trio when they were in Oakland because of Mulder's injuries. Now, Hudson's rebounding now with the Braves.
Yes.
But I would still take Zito, and I would take Zito over any other lefty in the game. I know he's having a bad year now, but that's how I will defend Barry Zito.
Yeah, but I'm going to say again, since his 2002 Cy Young campaign, he's never won more than 16 games in a season since
that
time.
Well, where's the run support in Oakland? You don't get run support in Oakland.
I agree with you, but also his strikeout ratio has gone down every single year since 2002. His ERA has ballooned up to 4.5 in 2004 when he was with Oakland. And his ERA, besides his year in 2003, which is 3.3, hasn't had an ERA since then under 3.8. And that does not justify having a salary as inflated as his is. I just don't see it.
He has the worst teammate in Major League Baseball. How about that?
He has that.
With Barry Bonds.
I will say this about San Francisco. With them losing Jason Schmidt, they needed to get someone who was a big-name pitcher. And Barry Zito is good, don't get me wrong, but I just don't think his stats previously and now justify him getting that kind of contract that he did.
I'll stick with Barry Zito being underrated because he plays a mean guitar. All right. Let's move on to our next one, and this one will be my pick. I am going underrated for the Florida Marlins shortstop Anley Ramirez. Last year, Rookie of the Year. Lead off with power. Now, you don't see that too often. Another guy in the NL East that kind of resembles that is J-Roll. But he looks like one of these guys that's going to be a five-tool player. He has all the makings of being the next star. And it kind of shows what Florida's done in the past with guys like Miguel Cabrera, Dontrelle Willis. Good Florida young prospects that are coming up through their system.
Yeah, definitely. The only thing about him that kind of scares me a little bit was last year. Granted, it was his rookie year. He had 128 strikeouts. That's a lot for a leadoff guy, and he only had 56 walks. So that kind of concerns me. His on-base percentage was only .353 last year. It is .388 this year. It looks like his strikeouts are going to be down. If he levels out to what he is right now, it's going to be about 8 strikeouts less than it was last year. But still, if it's 100-plus strikeouts and you're a leadoff guy, you kind of want to start having him being a little bit more patient. He is 23. He is going to become a lot better than he is now. But those kind of things, you know, kind of concern someone if you're looking at the stats.
Give this guy a little time. He's going to be a stud. And he almost reminds you of, like, a couple years ago in the AL when there was that loaded shortstop class of Tejada, Jeter, Rodriguez. He just seems to me like one of those guys who can do a little of everything. Good on-base percentage this year, .890. .314 batting average, you can't disagree with.
Yeah.
But definitely going to be a great player in the years to come.
You mean his OPS was .890, not his on-base percentage? His own base percentage was .890, that would be pretty good, and I probably would not be complaining about it right now. But let's get into my underrated, which is not a player per se, but actually my underrated persons are good NBA GMs. Now, you hear all the time about bad general managers, and we were just talking previously when we're speaking about Kobe Bryant.
Billy King.
Billy King for the Sixers is atrocious. Isaiah Thomas from the Knicks is bad. And Kevin McHale, who I don't think has had a first-round pick in the last 10 years, who is the guy for the Minnesota Timberwolves, he's atrocious. But they kind of overshadow guys that are doing really well with their respective franchises and franchises that they've taken over since their golden days. Such as, I mean, R.C. Buford's been with the Spurs for a long time. And he, besides taking Tim Duncan in the lottery when they drafted him number one, they haven't had a lottery pick since or a big free agent signing, and this is the same team that has won 3 NBA championships since 1999.
And 10 straight years in the playoffs.
10 straight years in the playoffs. They might win their 4th title this year, and they could arguably go down as one of the greatest teams of all time. Now, there's also Brian Colangelo, who used to be with the Suns. He is now with the Raptors. With the Suns, he signed Steve Nash, who I believe you're going to go into, and I'm going to argue vehemently about him. Steve Nash has won the MVP in 2005 and 2006. Colangelo drafted the likes of Amari Stoudemire and Sean Marion, who have both become superstars. And with the Raptors, he's taken them to the playoffs for the first time since Vince Carter departed. Now, let's get into the man that is the logo of the NBA, Jerry West. He won 4 titles as a GM of the Lakers during the 1980s. Following a little slump during the 90s, he acquired the rights to Kobe Bryant from Charlotte for Vlade Divac. Now, I'll say that again.
Very true.
I'll say that one more time. Jerry West obtained the rights to Kobe Bryant from the Charlotte Hornets for Vlade Divac. And not only that, he also helped the Grizzlies win 50 games in 2004 for the first time in history. And during West's tenure in Memphis, the Grizzlies appeared in the playoffs 3 straight years from 2004 to 2006. Now, after failing to reach the playoffs this year and having the worst record, he did retire, but you can't fault the man for having 4 titles for the Lakers, plus what he won with Bryant and Shaq, and then what he did with the Grizzlies, who was a horrible team before he got there.
You know, I can't really argue with you that good NBA GMs are a valuable commodity and so important to the success of teams. A couple examples I thought of: the Bulls, how they've, in the last couple of years, they've had good drafts. Pistons with Dumars, keeping the core together, the starting five. And that's what it's all about, a good GM, keeping the team nucleus together, like Parker, Ginobili, Duncan, and San Antonio.
Right.
So that's definitely the case. Now we'll keep in the NBA, and we will talk about one of my most overrated players, a guy named Steve Nash.
Okay, and speak your piece.
I will start by just saying that he doesn't have a ring, and I think that speaks volumes. If you look at Peyton Manning, Steve Young, Donovan McNabb, that's always the argument against them before Steve Young, before Peyton Manning won their championships. But to me, it's so important to win that ring. And they keep struggling, and they can't get past the big boys in the West. What does that tell me? That tells me that he's not a clutch player, and he can't perform in the playoffs. And go ahead, and you try to argue with me on this.
I just see as a guy, he's won 2 MVPs, 2005-2006. Without him on the Suns are absolutely nothing. They played without him when he was injured for this season, and they just won two games out of the 6 that they played.
I would like to butt in here and say,
go ahead.
Last segment, you said, and I quote, that Sean Marion and Amari Stoudemire are superstars. I think that has a lot to do with it, to be honest with you. I think Amari Stoudemire is the best center in the game, and I think he feeds off that. I don't like the flopping. I don't like the over-emotion on the Horry situation where he flailed his arms out like he got hit by Brian Urlacher. I just don't like him. I think he's overrated.
I'll give you that. He did flop during that game, and it's kind of odd that they're complaining about the Spurs flopping in that game, and then Steve Nash basically falls down and makes it the most dramatic thing ever. But I don't know about him being overrated. Some other people might agree with you. I certainly won't be one of them.
I think I stand alone in that debate. But we had a good show today, Brendan. Anything you want to say before we send it off?
No, not too much. Next episode, we'll definitely delve into the rest of the NBA playoffs, see how the Cavs and the Pistons game went, and if there's any other news that comes out during that time, we'll definitely clue you guys in and give you our take on it.
All right, everyone. This is Jason Mish for Brendan Canning. This has been a good show, and we'll talk to you guys later. To kill all the hate, but hip-hop's safe.